The Voice. After 5 hours, we were stuck. So the lieutenant in charge asked me to take over. Joe was out, I was in. Basically, it was the only strategic play at our disposal that didn't involve an escalation in force. The man we now knew as Chris Watts had been in the habit of ending his calls abruptly, so my job was to find a way to keep him talking. I switched into my late-night FM DJ voice, deep, soft, slow, and reassuring. I had been instructed to confront Watts as soon as possible about his identity. I also came onto the phone with no warning, replacing Joe against standard protocol. It was a shrewd move by the NYPD lieutenant to shake things up, but it easily could have backfired. This soothing voice was the key to easing the confrontation. Chris Watts heard my voice on the line and cut me off immediately, said, "Hey, what happened to Joe?" I said, "Joe's gone. This is Chris. You're talking to me now." I didn't put it like a question. I made a downward-inflecting statement in a downward-inflecting tone of voice. The best way to describe the late-night FM DJ's voice is as the voice of calm and reason. When deliberating on a negotiating strategy or approach, people tend to focus all their energies on what to say or do, but it's how we are, our general demeanor and delivery, that is both the easiest thing to enact and the most immediately effective mode of influence. Our brains don't just process and understand the actions and words of others, but their feelings and intentions, too, the social meaning of their behavior and their emotions. On a mostly unconscious level, we can understand the minds of others not through any kind of thinking, but through, quite literally, grasping what the other is feeling. Think of it as a kind of involuntary neurological telepathy. Each of us, in every given moment, signaling to the world around us whether we are ready to play or fight, laugh or cry. When we radiate warmth and acceptance, conversations just seem to flow. When we enter a room with a level of comfort and enthusiasm, we attract people toward us. Smile at someone on the street, and as a reflex, they'll smile back. Understanding that reflex and putting it into practice is critical to the success of just about every negotiating skill there is to learn. That's why your most powerful tool in any verbal communication is your voice. You can use your voice to intentionally reach into someone's brain and flip an emotional switch. Distrusting to trusting, nervous to calm. In an instant, the switch will flip just like that, with the right delivery. There are essentially three voice tones available to negotiators. The late-night FM DJ voice, the positive, playful voice, and the direct or assertive voice. Forget the assertive voice for now. Except in very rare circumstances, using it is like slapping yourself in the face while you're trying to make progress. You're signaling dominance onto your counterpart, who will either aggressively or passive-aggressively push back against attempts to be controlled. Most of the time, you should be using the positive, playful voice. It's the voice of an easygoing, good-natured person. Your attitude is light and encouraging. The key here is to relax and smile when you're talking. A smile, even while talking on the phone, has an impact tonally that the other person will pick up on. The effect these voices have are cross-cultural and never lost in translation. On a vacation to Turkey with his girlfriend, one of our instructors at the Black Swan Group was befuddled, not to mention a little embarrassed, that his partner was repeatedly getting better deals in their backstreet haggling sessions at the spice markets in Istanbul. For the merchants in such markets throughout the Middle East, bargaining is an art form. Their emotional intelligence is finely honed, and they'll use hospitality and friendliness in a powerful way to draw you in and create reciprocity that ends in an exchange of money. But it works both ways, as our instructor discovered while observing his girlfriend in action. She approached each encounter as a fun game, so that no matter how aggressively she pushed, her smile and playful demeanor primed her merchant friends to settle on a successful outcome. When people are in a positive frame of mind, they think more quickly and are more likely to collaborate and problem-solve, instead of fight and resist. It applies to the smiler as much as to the smiley. A smile on your face and in your voice will increase your own mental agility. Playful wasn't the move with Chris Watts. The way the late-night FM DJ voice works is that when you inflect your voice in a downward way, you put it out there that you've got it covered. Talking slowly and clearly, you convey one idea. I'm in control. When you inflect in an upward way, you invite a response. Why? Because you've brought in a measure of uncertainty. You've made a statement sound like a question. You've left the door open for the other guy to take the lead, so I was careful here to be quiet, self-assured. It's the same voice I might use in a contract negotiation when an item isn't up for discussion. If I see a work-for-hire clause, for example, I might say, "We don't do work-for-hire." Just like that. Plain, simple, and friendly. I don't offer up an alternative because it would beg further discussion, so I just make a straightforward declaration. That's how I played it here. I said, "Joe's gone. You're talking to me now. Done deal." You can be very direct and to the point as long as you create safety by a tone of voice that says, "I'm okay, you're okay, let's figure things out." The tide was turning. Chris Watts was rattled, but he had a few moves left in him. One of the bad guys went down to the basement and collected one of the female bank tellers. She'd disappeared into the bowels of the bank at some point, but Chris Watts and his accomplice hadn't chased after her because they knew she wasn't going anywhere. Now one of the bank robbers dragged her back upstairs and put her on the phone. She said, "I'm okay." "That's all." I said, "Who is this?" She said, "I'm okay." I wanted to keep her talking, so I asked her name, but then, just like that, she was gone. That was a brilliant move on Chris Watts's part. It was a threat, teasing us with the woman's voice, but subtly and indirectly. It was a way for the bad guy to let us know he was calling the shots on his end of the phone, without directly escalating the situation. He'd given us a proof of life, confirming that he did indeed have hostages with him, who were in decent enough shape to talk on the phone, but stopped short of allowing us to gather any useful information. He'd managed to take back a measure of control. Mirroring. Chris Watts came back on the phone trying to act like nothing had happened. He was a little rattled, that's for sure, but now he was talking. "We've identified every car on the street and talked to all the owners except one," I said to Watts. "We've got a van out here, a blue and gray van. We've been able to get a handle on the owners of all the vehicles except this one in particular. Do you know anything about it?" "The other vehicle's not out there because you guys chased my driver away," he blurted.
"We chased your driver away?" I mirrored.
"Well, when he seen the police, he cut."
"We don't know anything about this guy. Is he the one who was driving the van?" I asked.
The mirroring continued between me and Watts, and he made a series of damaging admissions. He started vomiting information, as we now refer to it in my consulting business. He talked about an accomplice we had no knowledge of at the time. That exchange helped us nail the driver of the getaway car. Mirroring, also called isopraxism, is essentially imitation. It's another neurobehavior humans and other animals display in which we copy each other to comfort each other. It can be done with speech patterns, body language, vocabulary, tempo, and tone of voice. It's generally an unconscious behavior. We are rarely aware of it when it's happening, but it's a sign that people are bonding, in sync, and establishing the kind of rapport that leads to trust. It's a phenomenon, and now technique, that follows a very basic but profound biological principle. We fear what's different and are drawn to what's similar. As the saying goes, birds of a feather flock together. Mirroring, then, when practiced consciously, is the art of insinuating similarity. "Trust me," a mirror signals to another's unconscious. "You and I, we're alike." Once you're attuned to the dynamic, you'll see it everywhere. Couples walking on the street with their steps in perfect synchrony. Friends in conversation at a park, both nodding their heads and crossing the legs at about the same time. These people are, in a word, connected. While mirroring is most often associated with forms of nonverbal communication, especially body language, as negotiators, a mirror focuses on the words and nothing else. Not the body language, not the accent, not the tone or delivery, just the words. It's almost laughably simple. For the FBI, a mirror is when you repeat the last three words, or the critical 1 to 3 words, of what someone has just said. Of the entirety of the FBI's hostage negotiation skill set, mirroring is the closest one gets to a Jedi mind trick. Simple, and yet uncannily effective. By repeating back what people say, you trigger this mirroring instinct, and your counterpart will inevitably elaborate on what was just said and sustain the process of connecting. Psychologist Richard Wiseman created a study using waiters to identify what was the more effective method of creating a connection with strangers, mirroring or positive reinforcement. One group of waiters, using positive reinforcement, lavished praise and encouragement on patrons using words such as great, no problem, and sure, in response to each order. The other group of waiters mirrored their customers simply by repeating their orders back to them. The results were stunning. The average tip of the waiters who mirrored was 70% more than of those who used positive reinforcement. I decided it was time to hit him with his name, to let him know we were onto him. I said, "There's a vehicle out here, and it's registered to a Chris Watts." He said, "Okay," not letting anything on. I said, "Is he there? Is this you? Are you Chris Watts?" It was a stupid question on my part, a mistake. For a mirror to be effective, you've got to let it sit there and do its work. It needs a bit of silence. I stepped all over my mirror. As soon as I said it, I wanted to take it back. "Are you Chris Watts?" What the hell could this guy say to that? Of course he replied, "No." I'd made a boneheaded move in giving Chris Watts a way to dodge this confrontation, but he was nevertheless rattled. Up until this moment, he'd thought he was anonymous. Whatever fantasy he had running through his head, there was a way out for him, a do-over button. Now he knew different. I composed myself, slowed it down a little, and this time shut my mouth after the mirror. I said, "No, you said okay." Now I had him, I thought. His voice went way up. He ended up blurting a few things out, vomiting more information, and became so flustered he stopped talking to me. Suddenly his accomplice, who we later learned was Bobby Goodwin, came onto the phone. We hadn't heard from this second hostage-taker until now. We'd known all along that Chris Watts wasn't acting alone, but we hadn't gotten a good read on how many people he had working with him on this, and now here was his unwitting accomplice, thinking our original police department negotiator was still handling our end. We knew this because he kept calling me Joe, which told us he'd been in the loop early on, and somewhat less involved as the stalemate dragged on. At the very least, the disconnect told me these guys weren't exactly on the same page, but I didn't jump to correct him. Another thing, it sounded like this second guy was speaking through a towel or a sweatshirt, like he was biting on some kind of fabric even, going to all these lengths to mask his voice, which meant he was clearly scared. He was nervous, jumpy as hell, anxious over how this standoff was going down. I tried to set him at ease, still with a downward-inflecting DJ voice. I said, "Nobody's going anywhere." I said, "Nobody's gonna get hurt." After about a minute and a half, the jumpiness seemed to disappear. The muffled voice, too. His voice came through much more clearly as he said, "I trust you, Joe." The more I kept this second guy on the phone, the more it became clear he was someplace he did not want to be. Bobby wanted out. And of course he wanted out without getting hurt. He was already in deep, but he didn't want it to get any deeper. He didn't start out that day planning to rob a bank, but it took hearing my calm voice on the other end of the phone for him to start to see a way out. The 7th largest standing army in the world was at the ready outside the bank doors, that's the size and scope of the NYPD in full force, and their guns were fixed on him and his partner. Obviously, Bobby was desperate to step out those doors unharmed. I didn't know where Bobby was inside the bank. To this day, I don't know if he managed to step away from his partner or if he was talking to me in plain sight of Chris Watts.
I only know that I had his full attention and that he was looking for a way to end the standoff, or at least to end his role in it. I learned later that in between phone calls, Chris Watts was busy squirreling cash inside the bank walls. He was also burning piles of cash in full view of the two female hostages. On the face of it, this was bizarre behavior. But to a guy like Chris Watts, there was a certain logic to it. Apparently, he'd gotten it in his head that he could burn, say, $50,000, and if $300,000 was reported missing, bank officials wouldn't think to go looking for the other $250,000. It was an interesting deception. Not exactly clever, but interesting. It showed a weird attention to detail. In his own mind, at least, if Chris Watts managed to escape this box he'd made for himself, he could lie low for a while and come back at some future date for the money he'd stashed away. Money that would no longer be on the bank's ledgers. What I liked about this second guy, Bobby, was that he didn't try to play any games with me on the phone. He was a straight shooter, so I was able to respond as a straight shooter in kind. The same way I'd get back whatever I put out, he was getting back whatever he was putting out. So I was with him on this. Experience told me all I had to do was keep him talking and he'd come around. We'd find a way to get him out of that bank, with or without Chris Watts. Someone on my team handed me a note. Ask him if he wants to come out. I said, "Do you want to come out first?" I paused, remaining silent. "I don't know how I'd do that," Bobby said finally. "What's stopping you from doing it right now?" I asked. "How do I do that?" he asked again. "Tell you what. Meet me out front right now." This was a breakthrough moment for us, but we still had to get Bobby out of there and find a way to let him know that I'd be waiting for him on the other side of the door. I'd given him my word that I would be the one to take his surrender, and he wouldn't get hurt, and now we had to make that happen. And very often it's this implementation phase that can be the most difficult. Our team scrambled to put a plan in place to bring this about. I started putting on bulletproof gear. We surveyed the scene, figuring I could position myself behind one of the big trucks we'd parked out in front of the bank to give me a measure of cover just in case. Then we ran into one of those maddening situations where one hand didn't know what the other was doing. It turned out the bank door had been barricaded from the outside early on in the standoff, a precaution to ensure that none of the bank robbers could flee the scene. We all knew this, of course, on some level, but when the time came for Bobby to give himself up and walk out the door, it's like our brains went into sleep mode. No one on the SWAT team thought to remind anyone on the negotiating team of this one significant detail, so for a couple long beats, Bobby couldn't get out, and I got a sick feeling in my stomach that whatever progress we'd just made with this guy would be for nothing. So there we were, scrambling to recover. Soon, two SWAT guys moved forward toward the entrance, with ballistic shields, guns drawn, to take the locks and barricade off the door. And at this point, they still didn't know what they were facing on the other side. It was a super tense moment. There could have been a dozen guns on these two SWAT guys, but there was nothing for them to do but make their slow approach. Those guys were rock solid. They unlocked the door, backed away, and finally we were good to go. Bobby came out, his hands in the air. I'd walked him through a specific set of instructions on what to do when he came out the door, what to expect. A couple of SWAT guys patted him down. Bobby turned and looked and said, "Where's Chris? Take me to Chris." Finally, they brought him around to me, and we were able to debrief him inside our makeshift command post. This was the first we learned that there was only one other hostage taker inside, and this naturally set the commander off. I didn't learn this until later, but I could see why he would have been angry and embarrassed at this latest turn. All along, he'd been telling the media there were a bunch of bad guys inside. An international assemblage of bad guys, remember? But now that it turned out it was essentially a two-man operation, and one of the bad guys had wanted no part of it, the commander looked like he didn't have a handle on the situation. But, like I said, we didn't know about the commander's reaction just yet. All we knew was that we'd just gotten all this new intel, which told us we were closer to achieving our desired outcome than we had just thought. This was a positive development, something to celebrate. With what we now knew, it was going to be a whole lot easier to negotiate our way through the rest of it. And yet this commander was angry. He didn't like that he'd been played, so he turned to one of the guys from NYPD's Technical Assistance Response Unit, TARU, and commanded them to get a camera inside the bank, a mic, something. Now that I was huddled with Bobby, the commander swapped me out in favor of another primary negotiator on the phone. The new negotiator played it the same way I had a couple of hours earlier, said, "This is Dominic. You're talking to me now." Dominic Mazzino was a great hostage negotiator. In my view, one of the world's great closers, which was the term often used for the guy brought in to bang out the last details and secure the deal. He didn't get rattled, and he was good at what he did. Matter of fact, street smart. Dominic plowed ahead. And then, an amazing thing happened. A nearly disastrous amazing thing. As Chris Watts was talking to Dominic, he heard an electric tool of some kind burrowing its way through the wall behind him. It was one of our TARU guys trying to get a bug planted inside. In precisely the wrong spot at precisely the wrong time. Chris Watts was already rattled enough as it was, his partner giving himself up like that and leaving him to play out the siege on his own. And now, to hear our guys drilling through the wall, it just about set him off. He responded like a pit bull backed into a corner. He called Dominic a liar. Dominic was unflappable. He kept his cool as Chris Watts raged on the other end of the phone, and eventually Dominic's cool, calm demeanor brought the guy from a boil to a simmer. In retrospect, it was a fool move to try to get a bug inside the bank at this late stage, born out of frustration and panic. We'd gotten one of the hostage takers out of the bank, but now we'd given back a measure of control. Startling the one remaining hostage taker, who may or may not have been a loose cannon, was absolutely not a good idea. As Dominic went to work smoothing over the situation, Chris Watts switched things up on us. He said, "What if I let a hostage go?" This came as if from nowhere. Dominic hadn't even thought to ask, but Chris Watts just offered up one of the tellers, like it was no big deal. And to him, at this late stage in the standoff, I guess it wasn't. From his view, such a conciliatory move might buy him enough time to figure out a way to escape. Dominic remained calm, but seized on the opportunity. He said he wanted to talk to the hostage first, to make sure everything went okay. So Chris Watts tapped one of the women and put her on the phone. The woman had been paying attention, knew there'd been some sort of snafu when Bobby wanted to give himself up, so even though she was still completely terrified, she had the presence of mind to ask about the door. I remember thinking this showed a lot of brass. To be terrified, held against your will, roughed up a bit, and to still have your wits about you. She said, "Are you sure you have a key to the front door?" Dominic said, "The front door's open." And it was. Ultimately, what happened was one of the women came out, unharmed, and an hour or so later the other woman followed, also unharmed. We were working on getting the bank guard out, but we couldn't be sure from the accounts of these bank tellers what kind of shape this guy might be in. We didn't even know if he was still alive. They hadn't seen him since first thing that morning. He could have had a heart attack and died. There was just no way to know. But Chris Watts had one last trick up his sleeve. He pulled a fast one on us, and out of the blue offered to come out. Maybe he thought he could catch us off guard one last time. What was strange about his sudden appearance was that he seemed to be looking about, surveying the scene, like he still thought he'd somehow elude capture. Right up until the moment the cops put the handcuffs on him, his gaze was darting back and forth, scanning for some kind of opportunity. The bright lights were on this guy. He was basically surrounded, but somewhere in the back of his scheming, racing mind, he still thought he had a chance. It was a long, long day, but it went down in the books as a success. Nobody was hurt. The bad guys were in custody. And I emerged from the experience humbled by how much more there was to learn, but at the same time, awakened to and inspired by the elemental power of emotion, dialogue, and the FBI's evolving toolbox of applied psychological tactics to influence and persuade just about anyone in any situation. In the decades since my initiation into the world of high-stakes negotiations, I've been struck again and again by how valuable these seemingly simple approaches can be. The ability to get inside the head, and eventually under the skin, of your counterpart, depends on these techniques and a willingness to change your approach based on new evidence along the way. As I've worked with executives and students to develop these skills, I always try to reinforce the message that being right isn't the key to a successful negotiation. Having the right mindset is. How to confront and get your way without confrontation. I only half-jokingly refer to mirroring as magic or a Jedi mind trick because it gives you the ability to disagree without being disagreeable. To consider just how useful that can be, think of the average workplace. Invariably, there is still someone in a position of authority who arrived at that position through aggressive assertiveness, sometimes outright intimidation, with old-school, top-down command-and-control assumptions that the boss is always right. And let's not delude ourselves. Whatever the enlightened rules of the new school, in every environment, work or otherwise, you will always have to deal with forceful Type A people who prefer consent to collaboration. If you take a pit bull approach with another pit bull, you generally end up with a messy scene and lots of bruised feelings and resentment. Luckily, there's another way without all the mess. It's just four simple steps. 1. Use the late-night FM DJ voice. 2. Start with, "I'm sorry." 3. Mirror. 4. Silence. At least 4 seconds to let the mirror work its magic on your counterpart. 5. Repeat. One of my students experienced the effectiveness of this simple process at her workplace, where her impulsive boss was known for his drive-bys, an infuriating practice by which the boss would suddenly swing by one's office or cubicle unannounced with an urgent, poorly thought-out assignment that created a lot of unnecessary work. Past attempts at any kind of debate created immediate pushback. "There's a better way" was always interpreted by this boss as the lazy way. Such a drive-by occurred toward the end of a long consulting engagement, one that had generated literally thousands of documents. The boss, still skeptical of anything digital, wanted the security of paper copies. Popping his head into her office, the boss said, "Let's make 2 copies of all the paperwork." "I'm sorry, 2 copies? She mirrored in response, remembering not only the DJ voice, but to deliver the mirror in an inquisitive tone. The intention behind most mirrors should be, "Please help me understand." Every time you mirror someone, they will reword what they've said. They will never say it exactly the same way they said it the first time. Ask someone, "What do you mean by that?" and you're likely to incite irritation or defensiveness. A mirror, however, will get you the clarity you want while signaling respect and concern for what the other person is saying. "Yes," her boss responded, "one for us and one for the customer." "I'm sorry, so you are saying that the client is asking for a copy and we need a copy for internal use?" "Actually, I'll check with the client. They haven't asked for anything. But I definitely want a copy. That's just how I do business." "Absolutely," she responded. "Thanks for checking with the customer. Where would you like to store the in-house copy? There's no more space in the file room here." "It's fine. You can store it anywhere," he said, slightly perturbed now. "Anywhere?" she mirrored again with calm concern. When another person's tone of voice or body language is inconsistent with his words, a good mirror can be particularly useful. In this case, it caused her boss to take a nice long pause, something he did not often do. My student sat silent. "As a matter of fact, you can put them in my office," he said, with more composure than he'd had the whole conversation. "I'll get the new assistant to print it for me after the project is done. For now, just create 2 digital backups. A day later, her boss emailed and wrote simply, "The 2 digital backups will be fine." Not long after, I received an ecstatic email from this student. "I was shocked. I love mirrors. A week of work avoided." Mirroring will make you feel awkward as heck when you first try it. That's the only hard part about it. The technique takes a little practice. Once you get the hang of it, though, it'll become a conversational Swiss Army knife, valuable in just about every professional and social setting. Key lessons. The language of negotiation is primarily a language of conversation and rapport, a way of quickly establishing relationships and getting people to talk and think together. Which is why when you think of the greatest negotiators of all time, I've got a surprise for you. Think Oprah Winfrey. Her daily television show was a case study of a master practitioner at work. On a stage face-to-face with someone she has never met, in front of a crowded studio of hundreds, with millions more watching from home, and a task to persuade that person in front of her, sometimes against his or her own best interests, to talk and talk and keep talking, ultimately sharing with the world deep, dark secrets that they had held hostage in their own minds for a lifetime. Look closely at such an interaction after reading this chapter, and suddenly you'll see a refined set of powerful skills. A conscious smile to ease the tension, use of subtle verbal and nonverbal language to signal empathy, and thus security, a certain downward inflection in the voice, embrace of specific kinds of questions and avoidance of others, a whole array of previously hidden skills that will prove invaluable to you once you've learned to use them. Here are some of the key lessons from this chapter to remember. A good negotiator prepares, going in to be ready for possible surprises. A great negotiator aims to use her skills to reveal the surprises she is certain to find. Don't commit to assumptions. Instead, view them as hypotheses and use the negotiation to test them rigorously. People who view negotiation as a battle of arguments become overwhelmed by the voices in their head. Negotiation is not an act of battle. It's a process of discovery. The goal is to uncover as much information as possible. To quiet the voices in your head, make your soul and all-encompassing focus the other person and what they have to say. Slow it down. Going too fast is one of the mistakes all negotiators are prone to making. If we're too much in a hurry, people can feel as if they're not being heard. You risk undermining the rapport and trust you've built. Put a smile on your face. When people are in a positive frame of mind, they think more quickly and are more likely to collaborate and problem-solve instead of fight and resist. Positivity creates mental agility in both you and your counterpart. There are three voice tones available to negotiators. One, the late-night FM DJ voice. Use selectively to make a point. Inflect your voice downward, keeping it calm and slow. When done properly, you create an aura of authority and trustworthiness without triggering defensiveness. 2. The positive, playful voice. Should be your default voice. It's the voice of an easygoing, good-natured person. Your attitude is light and encouraging. The key here is to relax and smile while you're talking. 3. The direct or assertive voice. Used rarely. Will cause problems and create pushback. Mirrors work magic. Repeat the last three words, or the critical 1 to 3 words, of what someone has just said. We fear what's different and are drawn to what's similar. Mirroring is the art of insinuating similarity, which facilitates bonding. Use mirrors to encourage the other side to empathize and bond with you, keep people talking, buy your side time to regroup, and encourage your counterparts to reveal their strategy. Chapter 3. Don't feel their pain. Label it. It was 1998, and I was standing in a narrow hallway outside an apartment on the 27th floor of a high-rise in Harlem. I was the head of the New York City FBI crisis negotiation team, and that day I was the primary negotiator. The investigative squad had reported that at least 3 heavily armed fugitives were holed up inside. Several days earlier, the fugitives had used automatic weapons in a shootout with a rival gang, so the New York City FBI SWAT team was arrayed behind me, and our snipers were on nearby rooftops with rifles trained on the apartment windows. In tense situations like this, the traditional negotiating advice is to keep a poker face. Don't get emotional. Until recently, most academics and researchers completely ignored the role of emotion in negotiation. Emotions were just an obstacle to a good outcome, they said. Separate the people from the problem was the common refrain. But think about that. How can you separate people from the problem when their emotions are the problem? Especially when they are scared people with guns. Emotions are one of the main things that derail communication. Once people get upset at one another, rational thinking goes out the window. That's why, instead of denying or ignoring emotions, good negotiators identify and influence them. They are able to precisely label emotions, those of others, and especially their own. And once they label the emotions, they talk about them without getting wound up. For them, emotion is a tool. Emotions aren't the obstacles, they are the means. The relationship between an emotionally intelligent negotiator and their counterpart is essentially therapeutic. It duplicates that of a psychotherapist with a patient. The psychotherapist pokes and prods to understand his patient's problems, and then turns the responses back onto the patient to get him to go deeper and change his behavior. That's exactly what good negotiators do. Getting to this level of emotional intelligence demands opening up your senses, talking less, and listening more. You can learn almost everything you need, and a lot more than other people would like you to know, simply by watching and listening, keeping your eyes peeled and your ears open and your mouth shut. Think about the therapist's couch as you listen to the following sections. You'll see how a soothing voice, close listening, and a calm repetition of the words of your patient can get you a lot further than a cold, rational argument. It may sound touchy-feely, but if you can perceive the emotions of others, you have a chance to turn them to your advantage. The more you know about someone, the more power you have. Tactical empathy. We had one big problem that day in Harlem. No telephone number to call into the apartment. So for 6 straight hours, relieved periodically by 2 FBI agents who were learning crisis negotiation, I spoke through the apartment door. I used my late-night FM DJ voice. I didn't give orders in my DJ voice or ask what the fugitives wanted. Instead, I imagined myself in their place. "It looks like you don't want to come out," I said repeatedly. "It seems like you worry that if you open the door, we'll come in with guns blazing. It looks like you don't want to go back to jail." For 6 hours, we got no response. The FBI coaches loved my DJ voice, but was it working? And then, when we were almost completely convinced that no one was inside, a sniper on an adjacent building radioed that he saw one of the curtains in the apartment move. The front door of the apartment slowly opened. A woman emerged with her hands in front of her. I continued talking. All 3 fugitives came out. None of them said a word until we had them in handcuffs. Then I asked them the question that was most nagging me. Why did they come out after 6 hours of radio silence? Why did they finally give in? All 3 gave me the same answer. "We didn't want to get caught or get shot, but you calmed us down," they said. "We finally believed you wouldn't go away, so we just came out." There is nothing more frustrating or disruptive to any negotiation than to get the feeling you are talking to someone who isn't listening. Playing dumb is a valid negotiating technique, and "I don't understand" is a legitimate response. But ignoring the other party's position only builds up frustration and makes them less likely to do what you want. The opposite of that is tactical empathy. In my negotiating course, I tell my students that empathy is the ability to recognize the perspective of a counterpart and the vocalization of that recognition. That's an academic way of saying that empathy is paying attention to another human being, asking what they are feeling, and making a commitment to understanding their world. Notice I didn't say anything about agreeing with the other person's values and beliefs or giving out hugs. That's sympathy. What I'm talking about is trying to understand a situation from another person's perspective. One step beyond that is tactical empathy. Tactical empathy is understanding the feelings and mindset of another in the moment, and also hearing what is behind those feelings, so you increase your influence in all the moments that follow. It's bringing our attention to both the emotional obstacles and the potential pathways to getting an agreement done. It's emotional intelligence on steroids. As a cop in Kansas City, I was curious about how a select handful of veteran cops managed to talk angry, violent people out of fights, or to get them to put down their knives and guns. When I asked how they did that, I rarely got more than a shrug. They couldn't articulate what they did. But now, I know the answer is tactical empathy. They were able to think from another person's point of view while they were talking with that person, and quickly assess what was driving them. Most of us enter verbal combat unlikely to persuade anyone of anything because we only know and care about our own goals and perspective. But the best officers are tuned in to the other party, their audience. They know that if they empathize, they can mold their audience by how they approach and talk to them. That's why if a corrections officer approaches an inmate expecting him to resist, he often will. But if he approaches exuding calm, the inmate will be much more likely to be peaceful. It seems like wizardry, but it's not. It's just that when the officer has his audience clearly in mind, he can become who he needs to be to handle the situation. Empathy is a classic soft communication skill, but it has a physical basis. When we closely observe a person's face, gestures, and tone of voice, our brain begins to align with theirs in a process called neural resonance, and that lets us know more fully what they think and feel. In an fMRI brain scan experiment, researchers at Princeton University found that neural resonance disappears when people communicate poorly. The researchers could predict how well people were communicating by observing how much their brains were aligned. And they discovered that people who paid the most attention, good listeners, could actually anticipate what the speaker was about to say before he said it. If you want to increase your neural resonance skills, take a moment right now and practice. Turn your attention to someone who's talking near you, or watch a person being interviewed on TV. As they talk, imagine that you are that person. Visualize yourself in the position they describe, and put in as much detail as you can, as if you were actually there. But be warned, a lot of classic deal-makers will think your approach is soft-headed and weak. Just ask former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. A few years ago, during a speech at Georgetown University, Clinton advocated showing respect even for one's enemies, trying to understand and, insofar as psychologically possible, empathize with their perspective and point of view. You can predict what happened next. A gaggle of pundits and politicians pounced on her. They called her statement inane and naive, and even assigned she had embraced the Muslim Brotherhood. Some said that she had blown her chances at a presidential run. The problem with all of that hot air is that she was right. Politics aside, empathy is not about being nice or agreeing with the other side. It's about understanding them. Empathy helps us learn the position the enemy is in, why their actions make sense to them, and what might move them. As negotiators, we use empathy because it works. Empathy is why the three fugitives came out after 6 hours of my late-night DJ voice. It's what helped me succeed at what Sun Tzu called the supreme art of war, to subdue the enemy without fighting. Labeling. Let's go back to the Harlem doorway for a minute. We didn't have a lot to go on, but if you've got three fugitives trapped in an apartment on the 27th floor of a building in Harlem, they don't have to say a word for you to know that they're worried about two things, getting killed and going to jail. So for 6 straight hours in that sweltering apartment building hallway, the two FBI negotiating students and I took turns speaking. We rotated in order to avoid verbal stumbles and other errors caused by tiredness. And we stayed relentlessly on message, all three of us saying the same thing. Now, pay close attention to exactly what we said. It looks like you don't want to come out. It seems like you worry that if you open the door, we'll come in with guns blazing. It looks like you don't want to go back to jail. We employed our tactical empathy by recognizing and then verbalizing the predictable emotions of the situation. We didn't just put ourselves in the fugitive's shoes. We spotted their feelings, turned them into words, and then very calmly and respectfully repeated their emotions back to them. In a negotiation, that's called labeling. Labeling is a way of validating someone's emotion by acknowledging it. Give someone's emotion a name, and you show you identify with how that person feels. It gets you close to someone without asking about external factors you know nothing about. How's your family? Think of labeling as a shortcut to intimacy, a time-saving emotional hack. Labeling has a special advantage when your counterpart is tense. Exposing negative thoughts to daylight, it looks like you don't want to go back to jail, makes them seem less frightening. In one brain imaging study, psychology professor Matthew Lieberman of the University of California, Los Angeles, found that when people are shown photos of faces expressing strong emotion, the brain shows greater activity in the amygdala, the part that generates fear. But when they are asked to label the emotion, the activity moves to the areas that govern rational thinking. In other words, labeling an emotion, applying rational words to a fear, disrupts its raw intensity. Labeling is a simple, versatile skill that lets you reinforce a good aspect of the negotiation or diffuse a negative one. But it has very specific rules about form and delivery. That makes it less like chatting than like a formal art, such as Chinese calligraphy. For most people, it's one of the most awkward negotiating tools to use. Before they try to use it the first time, my students almost always tell me they expect their counterpart to jump up and shout, "Don't you dare tell me how I feel!" Let me let you in on a secret. People never even notice. The first step to labeling is detecting the other person's emotional state. Outside that door in Harlem, we couldn't even see the fugitives. But most of the time, you'll have a wealth of information from the other person's words, tone, and body language. We call that trinity words, music, and dance. The trick to spotting feelings is to pay close attention to changes people undergo when they respond to external events. Most often, those events are your words. If you say, "How is the family?" and the corners of the other party's mouth turn down, even when they say it's great, you might detect that all is not well. If their voice goes flat when a colleague is mentioned, there could be a problem between the two. And if your landlord unconsciously fidgets his feet when you mention the neighbors, it's pretty clear that he doesn't think much of them. We'll dig deeper into how to spot and use these cues in Chapter 9. Picking up on these tiny pieces of information is how psychics work. They size up their client's body language and ask him a few innocent questions. When they tell his future a few minutes later, they're really just saying what he wants to hear based on small details they've spotted. More than a few psychics would make good negotiators for that very reason. Once you've spotted an emotion you want to highlight, the next step is to label it aloud. Labels can be phrased as statements or questions. The only difference is whether you end the sentence with a downward or upward inflection. But no matter how they end, labels almost always begin with roughly the same words. It seems like, it sounds like, it looks like. Notice we said, "it sounds like," and not, "I'm hearing that." That's because the word "I" gets people's guard up. When you say "I," it says you're more interested in yourself than the other person. And it makes you take personal responsibility for the words that follow, and the offense they might cause. But when you phrase a label as a neutral statement of understanding, it encourages your counterpart to be responsive. They'll usually give a longer answer than just yes or no. And if they disagree with the label, that's okay. You can always step back and say, "I didn't say that was what it was. I just said it seems like that." The last rule of labeling is silence. Once you've thrown out a label, be quiet and listen. We all have a tendency to expand on what we've said. To finish, "It seems like you like the way that shirt looks," with a specific question like, "Where did you get it?" But a label's power is that it invites the other person to reveal himself. If you'll trust me for a second, take a break now and try it out. Strike up a conversation and put a label on one of the other person's emotions, It doesn't matter if you're talking to the mailman or your 10-year-old daughter, and then go silent. Let the label do its work. Neutralize the negative, reinforce the positive. Labeling is a tactic, not a strategy. In the same way a spoon is a great tool for stirring soup, but it's not a recipe. How you use labeling will go a long way in determining your success. Deployed well, it's how we as negotiators identify and then slowly alter the inner voices of our counterpart's consciousness to something more collaborative and trusting. First, let's talk a little human psychology. In basic terms, people's emotions have two levels. The presenting behavior is the part above the surface you can see and hear. Beneath, the underlying feeling is what motivates the behavior. Imagine a grandfather who's grumbly at a family holiday dinner. The presenting behavior is that he's cranky, but the underlying emotion is a sad sense of loneliness from his family never seeing him. What good negotiators do when labeling is address those underlying emotions. Labeling negatives diffuses them, or defuses them in extreme cases. Labeling positives reinforces them. We'll come back to the cranky grandfather in a moment. First, though, I want to talk a little bit about anger. As an emotion, anger is rarely productive, in you or the person you're negotiating with. It releases stress hormones and neurochemicals that disrupt your ability to properly evaluate and respond to situations. And it blinds you to the fact that you're angry in the first place, which gives you a false sense of confidence. That's not to say that negative feelings should be ignored. That can be just as damaging. Instead, they should be teased out. Labeling is a helpful tactic in de-escalating angry confrontations because it makes the person acknowledge their feelings rather than continuing to act out. Early on in my hostage negotiation career, I learned how important it was to go directly at negative dynamics in a fearless but deferential manner. It was to fix a situation I'd created myself. I'd angered the top FBI official in Canada when I entered the country without first alerting him, so he could notify the Department of State, a procedure known as country clearance. I knew I needed to call and assuage him to straighten out the situation, or I risked being expelled. Top guys like to feel on top. They don't want to be disrespected. All the more so when the office they run isn't a sexy assignment. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," I said when he answered the phone. There was a long pause at the other end of the line. "Who is this?" he said. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," I repeated. "It's Chris Voss." Again, there was a long silence. "Does your boss know you're here?" I said he did, and crossed my fingers. At this point, the FBI official would have been completely within his rights to tell me to leave Canada immediately. But by mentioning the negative dynamic, I knew I'd diffused it as much as I could. I had a chance. "All right, you've got country clearance," he finally said. "I'll take care of the paperwork." Try this the next time you have to apologize for a boneheaded mistake. Go right at it. The fastest and most efficient means of establishing a quick working relationship is to acknowledge the negative and diffuse it. Whenever I was dealing with the family of a hostage, I started out by saying I knew they were scared. And when I make a mistake, something that happens a lot, I always acknowledge the other person's anger. I've found the phrase, "Look, I'm an asshole," to be an amazingly effective way to make problems go away. That approach has never failed me. Let's go back to the cranky grandfather. He's grumpy because he never sees the family and he feels left out. So he's speaking up in his own dysfunctional way to get attention. How do you fix that? Instead of addressing his grumpy behavior, you acknowledge his sadness in a non-judgmental way. You head him off before he can really get started. "We don't see each other all that often," you could say. "It seems like you feel like we don't pay any attention to you, and you only see us once a year, so why should you make time for us?" Notice how that acknowledges the situation and labels his sadness. Here you can pause briefly, letting him recognize and appreciate your attempts to understand what he's feeling, and then turn the situation around by offering a positive solution.
For us, this is a real treat.
We want to hear what you have to talk about. We want to value this time with you because we feel left out of your life.
Research shows that the best way to deal with negativity is to observe it without reaction and without judgment. Then, consciously label each negative feeling and replace it with positive, compassionate, and solution-based thoughts.
One of my Georgetown University students, a guy named TJ, who worked as an assistant controller at the Washington Redskins, put that lesson to work while he was taking my negotiation class. The economy was in the toilet at the time, and Redskins season ticket holders were leaving in droves to avoid the cost. Worse, the team had been terrible the year before, and off-field player problems were alienating the fans. The team's CFO was getting more worried and cranky by the day, and 2 weeks before the season was to start, he walked by TJ's desk and slammed down a folder full of paper. "Better yesterday than today," he said, and walked away. Inside was a list of 40 season ticket holders who hadn't paid their bills, a USB drive with a spreadsheet about each one's situation, and a script to use when calling them. TJ saw right away that the script was a disaster. It began by saying that his colleagues had been trying to call for months and the account had been escalated to him. "I wanted to inform you," it read, "that in order to receive your tickets for the upcoming season opener against the New York Giants, you will need to pay your outstanding balance in full prior to September 10th. It was the stupidly aggressive, impersonal, tone-deaf style of communication that is the default for most business. It was all me, me, me from TJ, with no acknowledgement of the ticket holder's situation. No empathy, no connection. Just give me the money. Maybe I don't need to say it, but the script didn't work. TJ left messages. No one called back. A few weeks into the class, TJ rewrote the script. These weren't massive changes, and he didn't offer the fans any discounts. What he did was add subtle tweaks to make the call about the fans, their situation, and their love of the team. Now the team was your Washington Redskins, and the purpose of the call was to ensure that the team's most valuable fans, the delinquent customers, would be there at the season opener. The home field advantage created by you each and every Sunday at FedEx Field does not go unnoticed, TJ wrote. He then told them, "In these difficult times, we understand our fans have been hit hard, and we are here to work with you, and ask the ticket holders to call back to talk through their unique situation." Though superficially simple, the changes TJ made in the script had a deep emotional resonance with the delinquent ticket holders. It mentioned their debt to the team, but also acknowledged the team's debt to them. And by labeling the tough economic times and the stress they were causing, it diffused the biggest negative dynamic, their delinquency, and turned the issue into something solvable. The simple changes masked a complex understanding of empathy on TJ's side. With the new script, TJ was able to set up payment plans with all the ticket holders before the Giants game. And the CFO's next visit? Well, it was far less terse. Clear the road before advertising the destination. Remember the amygdala? The part of the brain that generates fear in reaction to threats? Well, the faster we can interrupt the amygdala's reaction to real or imaginary threats, the faster we can clear the road of obstacles, and the quicker we can generate feelings of safety, well-being, and trust. We do that by labeling the fears. These labels are so powerful because they bathe the fears in sunlight, bleaching them of their power, and showing our counterpart that we understand. Think back to that Harlem landing. I didn't say, "It seems like you want us to let you go." We could all agree on that. But that wouldn't have diffused the real fear in the apartment or shown that I empathized with the grim complexity of their situation. That's why I went right at the amygdala and said, "It seems like you don't want to go back to jail." Once they've been labeled and brought into the open, the negative reactions in your counterpart's amygdala will begin to soften. I promise it will shock you how suddenly his language turns from worry to optimism. Empathy is a powerful mood enhancer. The road is not always cleared so easily, so don't be demoralized if this process seems to go slowly. The Harlem high-rise negotiation took 6 hours. Many of us wear fears upon fears, like layers against the cold, so getting to safety takes time. That was the experience of another one of my students, a fundraiser for the Girl Scouts, who backed into naming her counterpart's